All right, okay. All right, I guess we could get started. It is June 21st, 2021, and this is collective bargaining negotiations with the United Faculty of Florida chapter at the University of West Florida and the University of West Florida Board of Trustees. And I'm Mike Battimore.
Dan Lucas.
Kim LaDuff.
Amy Sprague.
Michael Wyatt.
John Fink.
Cassidy Hobbs.
All right. Sounds good. We have a revised Article 14 to share today. But Jonathan, if you had anything that you wanted to present or talk about first, we're glad to let you go forward.
No, go ahead. We've got a couple of small things. But yeah, I think the revised 14 would probably be good to start with. That sounds great.
All right. Gabby, could you share, can you transmit the latest version of Article 14 to Jonathan and his team, or can you share somehow, let them see it?
Yeah.
Yes, it's in the comment box.
Okay.
Okay, I've got it here. I've downloaded it.
Okay. So, Article 14. I think some of this language you've seen before. There's a couple of changes that I think we've presented in the past about layoffs, but draw a distinction between what a layoff is and what a furlough is. We continue to suggest language at 14.3 relative to a layoff, that there is a layoff notice period, is found in I'll find it in a second. Well, we'll find it. I'll find it in a second. Oh, here it is. Under 14.4, there's a layoff notice and a layoff notice period. So we have eliminated the last phrase in 14.1A that notifies the local UFF chapter of a layoff no less than 30 days prior to taking such action. But we just moved that language to 14.4 because that it's a notice provision. We think it's better found at 14.4, which is which speaks to the notice. We continue though in the previous paragraph, which is 14.3, to also say that during the layoff notice period, we will provide faculty members affected with the means to access and view university job openings and to advise human resources and the provost office of any of those openings that they have an interest in and believe that they're qualified for. So hopefully we're finding people other opportunities in the system per their personal interest and qualifications. So all of that stays the same. Then we go to page three. And on page three, we have the furlough language. Starting at 14.7. And so we define what a furlough is. It's the placement of an employee in a temporary unpaid leave from work status for a specified number of hours, days, weeks, or months. It's not a layoff or reduction in workforce, cannot be used for that. Layoff rights do not apply to a furlough. It may be instituted in order to preserve the financial well-being of the university and arises when there's a significant budget reduction due to a catastrophic event, reduction in state funding, or other loss of revenue that causes significant operating budget deficits, or in the event that work for an employee is unavailable. Okay. We've talked about that in the past. One of the issues that was raised in our exchange is how do we define where a furlough would take place? And the president may permit a university unit to implement a furlough. So a furlough would be at the unit level. That the division head created a plan and consulted, obtained approval from human resources prior to implementing, modifying, or terminating a furlough. Then we talk about what the benefits status is on furlough. An employee cannot use annual leave, sick leave, or compensatory leave. The university will pay the employer portion of the state of Florida health care and basic life insurance premiums. An employee is responsible for paying their share of any health care or basic life insurance premiums. The retirement decreases on contributions under the FRS would be adjusted accordingly based on earnings, since that's based on earnings. Their length of service, anniversary hire date is not impacted because they're on a furlough. Their original continuous service, length of service would remain unchanged. And they would receive annual leave on a prorated basis in accordance with university policy. And then, we do not blur lines during a furlough. Employees are not permitted to do work under the FLSA. Exempt employees must be furloughed in 7-day increments. There's no overtime to recoup wages. Employees that are on a contract or grant who have the work that can be performed that benefits the award is allowed per the sponsor award to be paid on that sponsored project. Such a person would be on a contract or grant that would continue, would not be considered furloughed or partially furloughed. Would reflect on the annual evaluation that an employee on furlough is not to perform any work duties during the furlough period. The process for a furlough is grievable, but the basis, the motivation driving the university to have to do the furlough is not grievable. And then we have a notice provision for furloughs. The employee receives notice no less than 7 calendar days prior to the furlough. So hopefully it'd be a lot more than that notice, but it would never be less than 7 calendar days. The notice would have the duration of the furlough. And if the furlough is modified, the employee will receive written notice no less than 7 days. And then, like the parallel obligation to notify the UFF, the university would notify the local UFF chapter and the UFF state office no less than 30 days prior to taking such an action. So that's what we have for your consideration today. And that's that.
Thank you, Mike, for walking through that. Just from a quick look in as you're walking through it, I think we're definitely a lot closer than we were previously. I think it also works well to differentiate the furlough language from the layoff language, right? And so I think that's a good distinction. Can you talk a little bit, the two things that kind of jump out to me just as you're walking through it is the primary one is just that the definition of furloughing at the unit level. I know that the how to define a unit is something that is a conversation I think that probably takes place statewide, and there's different, I think, discussion elements about what goes into a unit. Could you talk a little bit about the rationale behind like a targeted furlough at the unit level?
Well, it would, the way that we're kind of building this up is that and maybe even Jamie might be able to, or Kim might be able to help me with this, but the president, as we see this process working, the president would recognize that there would be a need for a furlough and would direct the division head to create a plan. What level is division head, Jamie?
Division head would be vice president for all the divisions except the president's division.
Okay. And then, so a furlough would be implemented at a university unit, which is what you're asking. Jonathan, I mean, my thought when I read this was that a unit is kind of akin to a department, but Dan, Jamie, do you think otherwise? Am I right about that?
You're correct. We do define a unit as a department level. A unit could also be, it is that level. It's the department level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there may be some instances where a unit is defined even more narrowly than a department. But we agree with that reading that unit is potentially down to the department level. I think the concern that we're trying to balance and represent from faculty is that, you know, furloughs, as we've talked about, are different from layoffs, right? Furloughs are not intended to be punitive in some way or are a reflection of performance. That furloughs are, based on our understanding, are intended purely to recoup financial investments and are considered temporary by definition. The concern among faculty is that if furloughs can be implemented on the departmental level, that potentially that financial burden would fall disproportionately on individual departments, right? And so it's like, okay, well, we're going to furlough this one specific department to recoup funds while the others are continuing to work and to have employment during that time. So that's the concern that we're attempting to balance here. It's understandable on the layoff level that layoffs can be at the unit level, right? Because layoffs are different. They have you can lay off a department for performance or for whatever, you know, those kind of reasons may be. And so that's the main thing I think that we're trying to balance is that concern about like a narrowly targeted furlough that's gonna disproportionately affect faculty within a singular department.
Okay, but this is an interesting conversation. By using unit and by using the department, I think what the university wants to do is to be able to, if they ever had to do a furlough, to be surgical enough with it so that someone could be furloughed, but the we would have some control over the ability to leave sufficient faculty in place to be able to deliver instruction in a particular area. So if you thought about it in a construct, if we go higher than that, let's say we go to a college level, we now lose control over where the furlough specifically hits. Because we're probably furloughing, you know, let's say we do a furlough at a college and we're not furloughing everyone, right? We could furlough everyone.
Go ahead, Kelly.
I was going to use as an example. So, you know, I mean, we've had some really serious talks in the last year about some of the budget challenges that we have, and I'll use my division as an example. So one of the things that we had to look at is, you know, if we had to, so one of the way that I approached it, so first off, from the university level, we didn't approach it by division or department. We used program codes, which meant that everybody kind of shared the lack of wealth, for lack of a better way to phrase it. And so in each division, we had to take a very realistic look at if we had to make cuts, where would those cuts have to be made? So I'll use it as an example in my area. We, during the pandemic, traffic and activity picked up in places like advising and tutoring and mental health counseling. But then when you look at an area like international, they had nothing going on for a while, right? And so that's where I think this comes in. If we have to make decisions, you kind of have to make it based on where you have to shift in that particular time frame. And I think that would be the danger, kind of like what Mike said, if you put it at a level that was too high, you know, if I would have had to make those cuts across the board, how would I have managed those very busy areas when I could see that I had an area that they just didn't, quite honestly, have the work at the time. And so I'll use that as an example of how that sometimes plays out at the division level. So,
yeah, I think that absolutely makes sense, Kim, and it's understandable. I mean, the example Mike gave previously was related to, like, if you don't have students on campus, you don't necessarily have people who need to be in the cafeteria serving, you know, sort of food. And I think that that's understandable. The way in which that's applied to faculty, I'm unaware of situations where you would have some teaching obligations and not others that would exist during a furlough. I also don't know, I mean, it sounds like you're saying that the university's intent could be to maintain instruction and keep the university open even while they are furloughing some faculty.
Well, unless a furlough occurred during a period of time when there was no active instruction, I don't know, I guess that could be the case, right? I mean, we would have to cover classes. Let's say an emergency necessitating a furlough occurs in the middle of a semester or in the middle of the summer, I don't know. We wouldn't be able to furlough faculty and then tell students that are enrolled in courses that they're not going to be offered in the middle of a semester, right? I mean, that's probably, we can all be honest that regular faculty delivering instruction in most cases will not be a group of employees that will be furloughed because of that reason. But I think Kim's point is well taken. There may be a unit where there's no instruction being provided during a period of time, or maybe someone who's in a support capacity, still is in the bargaining unit, but is in a support capacity and advising. I know probably that advising has been has been viewed as a more critical function throughout the university system over the last couple of years. So it's a bad example for me to use, but we could probably furlough advisors for 2 weeks and everyone just has to rearrange their appointments or something. But if we have somebody who's standing in front of a course of students and they're mid-semester, I don't see how that person could get furloughed, right?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting scenario, right? So let's say the university hypothetically decided to implement a furlough for 2 weeks in the middle of the semester, right, for teaching faculty, right? So if that happens, faculty are required by the terms of a furlough not to participate in work, right? And knowing faculty, I think that's going to be very hard for them, right? Like it's going to be hard to stop, you know, because they want to keep everything up to date and working, and they're required by the terms of the furlough not to grade, not to answer emails, because that's what a furlough is, right? So then in that scenario, they would have to stop, the class would have to stop for that 2 weeks, right? Because the faculty are not allowed to do work. I don't think there'd be any provision or that faculty would support allowing someone else to come into that space who's not furloughed for 2 weeks to cover that class, right, or to enter into that classroom space. I think that would be a whole other kind of conversation. But it gets complicated along those lines, of course, as well. The main thing that the concern that we hear from faculty is when a furlough of in-unit faculty could be targeted to a specific unit, what we hear from faculty is a range of anxiety, I guess is the way to put it. We have like the highest paid faculty, right? Like maybe senior faculty in College of Business, right? They say, well, look, they're just going to furlough senior accounting and finance faculty because our salaries are twice as much or have something like that, right? They'll say they're going to target the most expensive, right? You have other faculty who are in the humanities say, oh, well, they're just going to target these departments, right? For whatever reason. So we hear you that the university believes that there needs to be flexibility in that application based on the practicality of implementing furloughs. I think there's also space to balance this concern of faculty that they want to make sure that furloughs are done for the shortest time possible and as inclusively and widely spread and equitably as possible, right? And so we'll go back and look at the language. There may be a way to invert the structure a little bit as if to potentially say like that furloughs will be used as widely as possible, but there may be individual elements which are allowed to remain open during a furlough or something like that to invert it, that structure to provide some of that flexibility. But we'll review it. I think that's probably the central element that we're looking at now.
Yeah, it is something we're going to have to tackle, and it is something we have to tackle up front, so that everybody knows what an acceptable furlough plan would be, and whether it can impact individuals in a unit, but not all individuals in the unit. So that's a question I think we have to deal with. Because I mean, in the layoff area, we can do either in a unit. We can lay off part of the unit, or we can lay off the entire unit. So we have that flexibility there, and sometimes that needs to come into play, like when Florida International University decided that wanted to go to the business of industrial engineering, They were going to go out, they were going to lay off 11 faculty members who taught in the unit of industrial engineering. But at the same time, they needed to teach out. So it was going to be a four-year plan. So that exists now in layoff. It doesn't exist now in the language we have on the table in furloughs, but it's something we need to talk about.
Well, and that's and you know, we agree that layoffs are separate from there. They have a different intent or a different scope than furloughs. We'll go back and review it and look at it. I think we're actually pretty close. These are important issues to talk about, but these are things that we're pretty close on. Chastity, did you have other things that you wanted to mention or questions that you have?
I do. I have two questions. The first one is about the section that mentions that the employee is responsible for paying their insurance, and which is something currently that employees don't do. And Jamie, maybe you can answer this one. That's not something that faculty know how to do, because the university is currently doing that. So if, we have a 2-week period where it's faculty's responsibility, how does that look? How does that happen?
We've talked about this, and we'd have to put a process in place if we actually implemented a furlough. You can do it one of two ways. We can set it up where you give us the check and we send it to FRS, or we can set it up, to the state. I shouldn't just say FRS, but to the state. Or we can set it up where you send it to them and keep us out of the loop. So that's the one of the two ways it would happen, but we haven't finalized that. But you would be responsible for that portion.
Yeah, and that's understandable. It's just, do we need to have a process in place for how faculty would do that?
We don't have to have a process in place to accept the article. If we implemented a furlough, we'd have to have a process in place prior to implementing the furlough.
Great. Thank you, Jamie. And then my other question is about the 30 days versus 7 days. I was just wondering if you guys could explain the rationale for that. So at the very end of the article, it mentions that UFF would know 30 days prior to furlough implementation, but that faculty members could be up to 7 days. So I'm just wondering the rationale and that difference of timing.
Notifying the UFF within 30 days would be notifying UFF that the University of West Florida is going to implement a furlough. We may at that time not have identified the individuals who would have been furloughed. So then that's why we have to notify the individuals within 7 days.
If I could jump in here too. 30 days, if we were to implement a furlough, even if we agree up front on how a furlough would be carried out, if we gave you notice, the UFF notice, 30 days out, you would still have an opportunity to request impact bargaining. Mm-hmm. And the impact bargaining might affect who we give individual notice to. So we're building in some time for that process. We don't want to give notice to, let's say if we gave notice to an individual and notice to the UFF at the same time, and we had an impact bargaining session, and as a result of that, we tweaked the furlough plan, we don't want to go back and tell people, oh, now you're not furloughed.
Right.
Or somebody, that person got a notice, but now you get a notice instead of them because we've tweaked it as a result of a meeting. So that's the difference.
Right. A notification to UFF is that the university is considering furloughs, not what the actual furlough structure is going to be. Just to be clear.
Maybe not. I mean, we may have already developed a pretty good idea about how the furlough would look, and then we would be able to sit down and talk about that.
Mike, that might also be, this is not a proposal, but it's just a conversation. That might also be a path forward to resolving the unit issue. If there's time, if the university, if they have this 30-day notice, right, to UFF, that could give us potentially time to impact bargain the scope of the furlough, right? Like the unit that, the level of unit that's impacted. Right. There might be a way to implement language into this that addresses both of those concerns along those lines.
Right.
Okay.
That was it.
Go ahead, Chastity.
Sorry, that was all. Thanks.
Okay. Well, and we'll just so I'm clear on the format of the proposal, everything now that's in strike through and underline is based off the original language of the article. Is that correct? I know we put it back and forth a few times.
I don't know. Dan, do you know? I haven't been following the iterations to be able to answer whether this was off our last offer or the first offer or what.
I can answer that. Jonathan, we accepted in the first section where you wanted to keep layoff and furlough separate. So we kept that. And then on 14.3, we went back to our original language that we had proposed. In 14.4, I just moved, like he said, the notice from the first section to the layoff. And then back on the furlough section, we went back to our original language. And then in the very last section where you used the word possible instead of particular, we kept the word possible.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And absolutely. My question was just, it was even more basic than that, Jamie. I was just asking if everything in red in underline is new language and everything is strike through that there's not language that's been proposed and accepted. It's all returned back referencing the original document is all.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, good. Just making sure. Okay, we'll take this back and go through it and send it to faculty and think about ways to navigate some of the things we've talked about. A couple of things that we had, we've had faculty, Mike, you had sent me an email asking if we had planned to ratify that MOU separately from the rest of the contract, about the MOU about the bonus and the Article 25. My understanding is still that we can't bifurcate ratification of a contract, that those ratified documents have to be done simultaneously. Faculty have asked us just about what's the university status on the distribution of the bonus, what their timeline is on that. Did you guys have any updates or thoughts on that following the MOU?
I know that they've had some conversations and we agreed to move forward with the MOU that you and Mike Matamore signed, and it will be paid on June 25th.
Okay. That's a quick answer. I'll let them know to keep an eye out on June 25th. Thank you, Jamie, for doing that. A couple of other items that we had. One of the things that I think we'll need to talk about going forward is the university put forward a policy about the conflict of interest reporting outside activity. It's a policy that's reflecting primarily the changes to the statute. It's the 1012-977 statute. There's elements of that I think that we would want to make sure and that I think need to be brought into bargaining. These articles are open. They're certainly open right now. A couple of things about it. So number one, we certainly recognize the obligation for the university to follow Florida statutes and law. Like we're not, there's no question about following the statute, right? We recognize that an arbitrator cannot provide a ruling that goes against Florida statute, right? Like those are things that we recognize, right? However, there's elements in the policy that in our reading go beyond the scope of the statute itself, and that those are elements that need to be brought into bargaining, because we have an open, because we already have an established conflict of interest outside activity article. I could go through some of the elements that we've marked and articulated in the policy if you would like, but if you guys had any thoughts, I don't know if you're currently planning to bring that material into bargaining or what your thoughts were on that before I kind of maybe go through some of those things.
I mean, if there's a few points you want to make, I think we can listen. We were working on drafting that article, and that's, you know, why it was open, because we knew that that was something we needed to work on. But if you wanted to make a few comments, we'll certainly listen.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Dan. That's good. Our number one question was just checking to make sure that you guys were planning to bring this material to bargaining. So that's good. That sounds, that's what I hear you saying, is you're planning on bringing in material that reflects that as well. So that's good. A couple of elements in, and these are all things that can be bargained, of course. It's not that they're, you can't bring them into bargaining. The element about, in the policy, there was language about faculty annually articulating whether or not they have outside activity or not. This is something we've talked about in the past prior to negotiating this, which is, do faculty have an obligation to report an absence of outside activity? Currently, under the CBA, they do not have an obligation to report an absence of outside activity. The statute, as I read it, the new language, also it says at a minimum, faculty will report their outside activity. It does not create an explicit obligation to report an absence of outside activity. Now, if the university believes that that's something that would be beneficial, we can negotiate the terms of how one goes about reporting an absence of outside activity. So that was one element certainly that caught our eye in the policy, but it sounds like you guys are bringing that into bargaining. So those are things that we can address within the bargaining structure as well. So that was one element. A couple of other things that caught our eye in the policy itself, there's language in the policy about, let me find it real quickly, that maybe you could provide some context on. It's this language that says, a determination by the university not to object to an outside activity or employment does not preclude a finding from the Florida Commission on Ethics that the activity or employment is not in accordance with all applicable laws and regulations respecting conflict of interest, right? So it
Jonathan,
was, it was,
can you tell me what section that is?
Sure.
Please.
In the policy, it's in section 6. A2.
Okay, I'll have to go back and look at it.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about, we were just a little bit unfamiliar with the Florida Commission on Ethics and the way in which that they would sort of enter into this scenario. Our concern might be that a faculty member following their due process and in good faith would submit their conflict of activity forms. That form would be approved by the university, but then they could potentially still be subject to some sort of disciplinary action if this outside body were to intervene in some way. So that I don't really know a lot about that process of what the Florida Commission on Ethics is.
Jonathan, I don't have it in front of me, but what is Section 6 entitled?
It's the... it's the outside activity and conflict of interest. And then the subsection is reporting conflicts of interest.
Okay.
Right. So it's just a subsection that says, basically, even though an outside activity may be approved by the university, that doesn't prevent this Florida Commission on Ethics to say that it's not in accordance or to intervene in some way and say it's not an appropriate outside activity.
Yeah, so I'm not familiar with the policy section 6, but just generally in Florida statute, there's a code of ethics that applies to all public employees and officers. And there is a commission on ethics, which is a group of people that have been appointed by the governor. And the commission on ethics has been around for, since I've been a lawyer. So it's probably been around for many years. And anyone can file a complaint with the commission on ethics, complaining that a public officer or employee has violated the code of ethics. They investigate. They have investigators. They investigate whether or not that's the case, and then they make a determination whether or not there's been a violation. And if there's a violation, they have all sorts of remedial authority. They can direct, well, they can remove people from office. They can levy fines. They can do that. They're a pretty powerful bunch, to tell you the truth. So I guess without having seen the policy, we're all subject to the code of ethics, and we're all subject to the decisions of the commission on ethics as individuals. Well, not me, because I'm not a public employee, but so I can be as unethical as I want, but you all can.
So that's an element that we kind of wanted to look at, which ties into some of the other elements that we recognize in this language too. The language of the statute has explicit language about potentially being subject to termination, right? And that's explicit within the statute. I think in bargaining, one of the things to anticipate is we would also want to make sure that this corresponds with the disciplinary action language as well, the disciplinary action article. Now, the disciplinary action article already, while there is a commitment to progressive discipline, it does have language that says that for especially egregious violations, the university does not have to follow progressive discipline. I'm just kind of paraphrasing right now. There's already language that says that the university can move towards termination. I think we would want some language that shows how the disciplinary action article and the disciplinary items of this reporting conflict of interest, how those are in connection to each other.
Jonathan,
yeah, Jamie, go ahead.
Are you referring to the research part that says if you don't report, then you could be put on suspension without pay for up to 60 days?
Well,
is that the one you're referring to?
It's a couple places in here where it mentions disciplinary action.
Okay, that one specifically is in the Florida statute, and that's their language about the research piece.
Absolutely, and I've got it here, the statute in front of me, and it says, you know, the university or entity may terminate the contract of the employee, right? You know, and so it's qualified with the word may, right? Like there's an element of discretion in there. The way in which there's an element of discretion currently in the disciplinary action article, right? That's in the CBA about commitment to progressive discipline. I think that what we would be looking for is language that does not contradict this, but also states that the disciplinary action is simultaneously covered by the disciplinary action article. We don't see these as necessarily in conflict. We would probably want to have those demonstrated as working together. And we can wait and look at the specific language when you guys bring it in. I had one more quick question I had on this. We appreciate in this the further clarification of the kind of things that need to be reported and the kind of things that don't need to be reported for outside activity. I think that, you know, clarification on that is helpful. I think that, you know, my understanding is that with the recent reporting, I think faculty in good faith, a lot of them, you know, reported a whole bunch of things that maybe the university was like, look, you don't need to report, you know, Sunday school teaching or, you know, things kind of like this stuff throughout. When I'm looking at this, I would be a little bit confused because, I'm sorry. Hey, Dean, I think you may be.
Here's my suggestion right now. Okay.
Hang on. Let me get Dean. Dean might be projecting. Hey, Dean. Thank you. Okay. So right now, under the requirement for things to report, it says presentation at professional meetings in which an honorarium is being paid to the employee, right? My reading on this or takeaway from the policy is that basically anything that's compensated and professional needs to be reported. And that may be incorrect, but I would read that as any sort of a presentation at a professional meeting that I, as a faculty member, I would receive an honorarium for, I need to report that. But then I would feel a little bit confused when you flip over for the things that don't need to be reported, right? It lists peer review of articles and research proposals, editorial services for educational or professional organizations, conducting workshops for professional societies or musical or creative performances and exhibitions that are consistent with the faculty member's discipline. As a creative writing professor, you know, I'll frequently give, you know, just readings of my published work or those sort of things. And I receive an honorarium for that, a modest honorarium, but it's an honorarium for that. So I know in that scenario, I would feel conflicted and sometimes like peer review work may be compensated. You may be receiving an honorarium for that. The editorial services you could be receiving an honorarium for. And same things like with the conducting workshops, right? So I think there would need to be some clarification on these elements that are listed under things you don't have to report, clarifying if those things are compensated or uncompensated and if they need to be reported. So in other words, I would feel conflicted because here it says, oh, presentations at professional meetings in which an honorarium is being paid to an employee. I would say, okay, I have to report that. But then it says here, like the performances or the workshops or things, these don't have to be reported. But I'd be like, well, if I'm getting compensation for that, do I need to report those or not or get approval for it? So that's all, just some clarification.
All right. We can work on that.
Yeah. So that was just a few of the elements. Chastity, did you have other things on the policy that struck you that you wanted to mention? Or?
No, you covered it.
Okay. But otherwise, it's actually, I mean, I think there's a whole bunch that we're in agreement, and it actually will be beneficial to clarify, you know, what needs to be reported and what doesn't, and those sort of things. So we'll keep an eye out for that. The only other thing that we had, I'm going to send this to Gabby. Hang on one second. Okay. Gabby, I just sent you a document. One of the things, now we recognize in submitting this that there's absolutely no obligation for the university to accept what we're proposing here. This is just simply in a good faith attempt to codify in the contract some of the good work that we've done recently. One of the things that worked out really well is we were able to meet in consultation, and Mike, you were part of this, to meet in consultation to resolve the bylaw process. And basically what this conversation has been going on for a while. What we were able to do is to work with the document that the university had created outside of bargaining. So we worked in consultation with Mike and with Kimberly McCorkle about getting that document into a shared understanding of the bylaw approval process as in a way in which it would be compatible with the currently existing CBA. So we've gone through all of that. We now have a bylaw approval process that's not part of the contract that we met in consultation about, and that we've got that language in such a way that we're all in agreement that it complies with the CBA. The remaining element that what we're proposing today is that document right now is kind of a free-floating document. It's not attached to the CBA. It's not a policy. It's just kind of guidelines for approval. And so we were thinking about how can we make this document or the process more formalized. We also recognize the university's commitments and that resistance to wanting that entire process in the CBA. The university has articulated that previously. So we wrote up a short article that would be a new article into the CBA. And it's just a article that describes the process that we just went through. It articulates that the teams would meet in consultation, right? And then to develop this document. And then it goes through the language, reiterates language that's already in this existing bylaw document that we worked through in consultation, just saying that it has to be in compliance with the CBA. We felt like having this in the CBA would be a good structure also for the future. We have, a really good collaborative set of teams right now working on these items. You know, that may not always be the case depending on however the teams evolve. So we presenting this for your thoughts as a way to both recognize the concerns the university has brought forward in the past, and also to formalize that process, which we just went through a little bit as well.
Okay, I've received a copy of it, we'll take this under consideration. Has the rest of my team received a copy of the proposed new Article 35? Okay. Does anybody have any questions or anything they would like to express with regard to this? Okay. So we'll take this back. I don't think anyone has anything. So, Jonathan, we'll take this back and consider. We'll get back to you.
Okay. That sounds great. That's everything we have today.
All right. Does anyone else have anything else they would like to do today? Okay. Good.
Chastity or Dean, anything else you guys wanted to add?
Not me.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Great. Well, okay. Thanks, everyone. Have a wonderful week, and see you soon.
Okay. Thanks.